Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You may find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org, or you can download an app onto your iPhone or your Android app and find out scheduling and other information about for podcasts of all the past programs. My name is Roy Eisenhart and I will be your moderator for tonight's program. I want to say also today's program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Humanity Forum. It's my pleasure now to introduce our speaker for tonight, Dr. Daniel Dennett. Dr. Dennett has quite an impressive resume, and I've done my best to give you the essentials. He is the Austin B. Fletcher Professor of Philosophy and co-director of the Center for Cognitive Studies at Tufts University. He's the author of books I'm sure you're familiar with if you know his writing, Breaking the Spell, Freedom Evolves, and Darwin's Dangerous Idea. Today he is here to discuss his latest book, Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. Dr. Dennett was born in Boston in 1942, received his BA in philosophy from Harvard in 1963. He then went to Oxford and received his doctorate in philosophy in 1965. From there, he taught at UC Irvine until 1971, where he went to Tufts, and he has taught there ever since. He is the author of over 300 scholarly articles on various aspects of the mind, published in journals ranging from Artificial Intelligence and Behavioral and Brain Sciences to Poetics Today and the Journal of Aesthetics and Art Criticism, a wonderful range. He would like us all to know that his principal vocation is spending his summers on his farm in Maine, sailing, and harvesting in his spare time blueberries, hay, and timber, making Normandy cider when he's not sailing. So, without further ado, please welcome Dr. Dennett.
Thanks very much. I've listened to this program often on the radio, and I'm honored to be here to talk today to the Commonwealth Club. One of my students once said, you can't do much carpentry with your bare hands, and you can't do much thinking with your bare brain. I think it's exactly right. The thinking we can do is thanks to the tools that we stuff into our brain, the tools that we learn to use, the thinking tools. And I've been making and criticizing and using thinking tools now for over 40 years as a philosopher. And I decided it was time to write a book which gathered up some of my favorites and show them to people and show them how they work, dispel any mysteries about how and why they work, and show how the bad ones can mislead you. So one of the main purposes of my book is to show you some defective thinking tools that people have devised and show you how to protect yourself against the intuitions that those tools pump. So what's an intuition pump? Well, it's a story, really. It's a little narrative. You might say that Aesop's fables were the original intuition pumps. They have a moral. You hear the story and it highlights and renders vivid and unforgettable a certain point. If all goes well, it's a point that you're well advised to take on board and live by. Those are sort of moral intuitions, but many intuition pumps in science and philosophy are, you might say, theoretical. They're trying to establish some point about the mind or about meaning or about free will or about ethics or about the nature of evolution. These are topics that have concerned me over the years. And I found that the best way that I know of getting clear about these are to devise intuition pumps that I can use to persuade, convince my audience that here's a good way of looking at it, and here some other way is maybe a bad way. So some of them are in effect critical and sort of destructive. They're trying to show what's wrong with somebody's view. And other times they are designed to promote a view. Now, my view of philosophy is that it's what you're doing when you don't know whether you're asking the right questions. And that's true in every field. There's The part of physics that's philosophy is when the physicists can't agree about their notion of matter or causation or time, and they're sort of casting about and wondering if they've got to change their perspective somewhat. In every field, when you aren't sure what the questions are, you are, by default, doing philosophy well or ill. And we philosophers specialize, I say, in working on the questions. Once we get the question down, we give it to somebody else to answer. That's somebody else's work. And actually, the history of philosophy, it was all philosophy back in Aristotle's day. And mathematics, physics, cosmology, medicine, these all got shelved off and turned into their own fields once the questions got clear enough so they could be dealt with in a somewhat more systematic and routine way. Some people might say that some fields had a sort of premature birth from philosophy, and they should go back into philosophy. Psychology is an obvious case. And we can date that, you know, very closely. If you go to Harvard, you see Emerson Hall, named after the philosopher Emerson. And in that hall, you had William James, a philosopher. And then down the road now, there's William James Hall. That's the psychology department. And some people thought, well, great as James was, psychology wasn't in good enough shape to become a proper science. Many would say it's still not in good enough shape. But for better or for worse, we now have what's called cognitive science, the science of neuroscience and psychology and artificial intelligence and philosophy and linguistics. And that's where I spend most of my time. And it is just a riot of interesting questions and a great place for intuition pumps. Now, thinking tools ought to make you smarter. If you can't do much thinking with your bare brain, then when you take on a tool, it should actually improve your performance. And there's some pretty good evidence that it really does. Oddly enough, not many people know about it. The Flynn effect, named after the psychologist James Flynn, although he didn't do the original work on this, is an absolutely stunning fact, and it runs as follows. In the last 80 or 100 years, people all over the world have gotten much better at taking IQ tests. IQ has risen. Now, if you look at the figures, you say, well, it can't, because every year they normalize to 100. 100 is normal, is medium, average. Above 100 is above average. And they tune the 100 to whatever it is that year. But here's the fact. A person that got 100 in 1930 would get about an 80 today with the same materials. That is, or if you give somebody today a 1930s test, they would score 20 points higher than they do on today's test. The tests have become more demanding. What explains this? Nobody knows for sure what accounts for the Flynn effect. It certainly isn't genetic. It has apparently nothing to do with how intensely you're tutored or studied. And it seems to be quite worldwide. And Flynn's idea, not yet proven but plausible, is that what's happened is that the thinking tools that have been developed in science and other professional activities over recent centuries have gradually sort of filtered down into common knowledge and techniques that people learn. They don't even learn them in school necessarily. They just grow up learning these ways of sharpening their thinking. A simple idea like percentage or odds. They're still treacherous in many ways, but kids have a better sense of them now than they had in the old days. And they seem to be smarter for it. Every word in your vocabulary is a tool. Some of them are labels, which very useful for keeping track of things and tracing their trajectories through the world. Some of them are reminders. Some of them are, in effect, little warnings, or they're great focus grabbers and holding your attention. Of course, we have many high-tech thinking tools, too. Computers are a great example. And in the book, there's a lot about computers, because I think everybody needs to understand how computers work. Don't just think of a computer as a black box, because you need to understand one particular feature of computers that make them such a great tool to add to your kit. When you succeed in writing a computer program that simulates something you're interested in, you know to a moral certainty there's no magic, there's no morphic resonance, there's no psionic forces, no wonder tissue. It's just good, honest, everyday causation at work, because that's what a computer does, and there's no room for any funny business. And this fact about computers is widely recognized, but I think it's important that you not only recognize it, but that you understand why it is so and how computers work, how all that arithmetic, which is what computers do, actually serves to represent anything at all that you want to represent, and then show what the relationships are between variables, between phenomena. They are a wonderful tool, and even if you're not and never want to be a computer scientist, you should know a little bit more about how they work. And that's one of the chapters, one of the areas in the book that I cover. Now I'm going to give you a few examples of simple tools. There are the stories, the intuition pumps proper. Then I give you some sort of simple hand tools first. And one of them is the surely alarm. Every time you see the word surely at the beginning of a sentence, a little bell should ring. Ding, surely, ding, surely, ding. The little bell alerts you and gets you to ask, hang on, is this one of those bad surelies? What would be bad about a surely? Well, why does the author use the word surely? To introduce a proposition that the author thinks is true and even rather obvious. But it's not so obvious that it goes without saying. If it were, he wouldn't have to say it. So it's not that obvious, and the author doesn't want to argue for it. He wants to excuse himself for arguing for it and just sort of nudge, surely. Now, I'm going to give you a couple of examples to practice. Okay, you ready for this? A robot might be able to sort fruit by its color, but surely, ding, it could never be made to appreciate a color or have a favorite shade of yellow. Well, maybe you think what follows the surely is obvious, but maybe it isn't. Some people might say, no, I guess that's not quite as obvious as the author pretends it is. Here, one more. You can cast a shadow through a clear pane of glass, but you surely can't cast a shadow. I didn't hear any dings. Really? Surely. Ding. Okay. Can't cast a shadow through a solid steel beam. Well, you might think, well, that's obvious. Are you ready to get worried? Here you go. This is a nice intuition pump of a friend of mine from many years ago. It's not in the book, by the way, but I want to introduce it to you. So you can't cast a shadow through a brick wall? Well, now let's just see. Suppose we have a light source over here to the side. And oh, here we have a brick wall. And here, in between the light and the brick wall, I'm going to hold up a gavel. The shadow of the gavel will be cast on the wall, will it not? Now, I take a solid penny out, and I put it right here between the gavel and the brick wall? Is the shadow of the gavel cast on the wall? But there's a solid, opaque object intervening. Is it cast through? Is it cast through the solid object? What people, the mistake that people make here, very natural, is we tend to think of shadows as beams of darkness. No, they're the absence of beams of light. And this is just a little example to alert you to how a word surely can lead you down a garden path quite innocently. I tested this out by going and looking at several dozen, probably 75 philosophy papers printed. I went to them online and searched them for the word surely and came up with more than a dozen surelys. Most papers don't have the word in it at all. But of those, actually more like two dozen, easily a third of them were papering over the crack in the argument. This is a nice way of finding a weak spot in an argument. It doesn't always work. Okay, so everybody's got the surely alarm now. Now look what I've just done. I've downloaded an app to your necktop. And I mean that quite literally. What you have between your ears is a brain, but it is a kind of computer, very different from a digital computer. But it is empowered by adding layers and layers of apps. Things, tools made out of information, tools which simply set up little habits in your mind. The surely alarm is a little bit like Google Alert. It serves the same sort of purpose. What is it made of? Nothing. You've simply acquired a little micro habit that you put in your head. Well, every word you know is a micro habit. Sometimes it pays to think of a word of your vocabulary as sitting there waiting, eager to get into the conversation. Saying again and again, wait a minute, is that one of the times? Let me take an example. You learn the term, this is from one of Doug Hofstadter's list of terms that are sort of vivid, loose cannon. Okay, so you've got the phrase, everybody knows what a loose cannon is. So you're looking around at the world, going about your business, and there's a little app in there that's looking at every event in your life saying, is that a loose cannon? Is that a loose cannon? Is that a loose cannon? Most of the time the answer is no. You're completely oblivious to this. Every now and then something happens where he's a loose cannon, is le mot juste. And because you got it in there, boom, it occurs and it reminds you to think about all the things that are implied by somebody being a loose cannon. Now I'm going to give you a thought experiment, an intuition pump that I recently devised to upset neuroscience friends of mine and cognitive scientists who were saying what I thought was something pretty actually irresponsible about free will. So here's the story of the nefarious neurosurgeon. First, a little science fact. There is a little microchip that you can now have installed in your brain which will do a pretty good job of curing you of obsessive compulsive disorder. It will certainly tame your OCD. My friend Damien Denise in Amsterdam is the creator and installer of this marvel. That's fact. But now here's a little fiction, science fiction. So this is a chap who has OCD. And he goes to get the chip installed, and his friendly neuroscientist installs the chip and does the brain scans and sews him up. And she says to him as he's about to leave, well, now your OCD is under control, and we wanted to let you know that our staff here will be monitoring you 24/7 electronically. And actually, when you think you're making a free decision, they'll be making it for you. You think you'll have free will, but that'll be an illusion. All your decisions are actually made by our very talented staff here at the clinic. Goodbye. Have a nice life. Sends him out, and he believes her. And as you might imagine, this encourages him to be a little bit negligent in how he plans his life. He's a little, he indulges in some of his worst features. He's a little aggressive, just because after all, he doesn't have free will. He's under the control of this team. So he just sort of lets her rip a little bit. And after a while, he does something pretty bad and gets caught, put on trial. And at his trial, he says, but I don't have free will. I'm under the control of the staff at the clinic. And the judge says, well, let's call the neurosurgeon in. They call her in and put her under oath on the stand. And they say, what did you tell this man? That he didn't have any free will anymore? That free will was an illusion? And she said, well, yeah, actually I did, you know. It was just a joke. I was messing with his head. Well, not a joke, not funny. In fact, how many of you would agree that what she did to him was not only irresponsible, but really harmful? She accomplished with words what she claimed to accomplish surgically. She disabled him, removed his free will, just by telling him in a very authoritative scientific voice that he didn't have free will. Well, I find that most of the cognitive scientists that I've told this story to, they agree. Shame on her. Shame on her. She did a really bad thing. I say, well, now tell me exactly. When you write articles in prestigious journals saying that neuroscience shows that nobody has free will, aren't you doing the same thing wholesale? Isn't that pretty mischievous too? Can you tell me exactly what is it that you've learned in neuroscience that convinces you that nobody has free will in the sense that underlies moral responsibility? And the fact is that the neuroscientists and the cognitive scientists who've written, it's become quite a chorus in the last few years about how neuroscience shows nobody has free will. They take the cheesiest, cheapest, most implausible view of free will out there in philosophy land, the libertarian view, so-called, which says that free will has to be free will is incompatible with determinism. And they, without even stopping to consider whether there's a better version, they decide that's what free will is. And they say, we can show that you don't have that. Well, you know, what else is new? Of course you don't have that. That would be a miracle. And free will isn't a miracle. But they don't show that free will in a better sense is shown not to exist by anything in neuroscience. And I devote a lot of energy in various places to trying to show how hard it would be to show that, because people really do have free will. For instance, I think everybody in this room believes that they have the competence, the moral competence, to sign a contract, to buy a car, to take out a mortgage of your own free will. Notice there's some people that don't have that competence. They're senile, or they're brain disorder in one sort or another. They're just small children. They don't have free will, but you do. Now, does neuroscience show that you don't have that kind of free will, that you are like a disabled person? No, not at all. Well, what if neuroscience shows that every event that occurs in your brain, every decision you make, is caused, determined by the events prior to that decision in your brain? Wouldn't that show that you don't have free will? No, it wouldn't. Really? Isn't the determination of choice by your brain, isn't that a sign that you don't have free will? No, it isn't. Here's another little intuition pump to help you see that. Consider two lotteries. In lottery A, the tickets are sold, and after A, for after the tickets are sold, the winning ticket is chosen. Okay, that's lottery A. Lottery B, before the tickets are sold, the winning ticket is chosen, the stub is put in a safe place to be opened up after the tickets are sold. Now, how many of you think that Lottery B is a fraud and that nobody should ever buy a ticket in Lottery B? Anybody? No, I don't see any hands. How many think that the two lotteries are equally fair as lotteries? That is to say, if you buy a ticket, you have a chance. You have an opportunity to win in either case. How many agree that that's the case? Good, most people do. I think you're right. And notice that public opinion very clearly says that that's right, because Publishers Clearinghouse for years has said, you may already have won. If people really thought that wasn't fair, then this would be stupid advertising on the part of Publishers Clearinghouse. But now think about it. If determinism is true, then every event in your brain is caused by prior sets of events, which are caused by prior sets of events, and so forth, back to the Big Bang. That millions of years, billions of years before you were born, if determinism is true. What does that mean? It means that all your lottery tickets were chosen back at the Big Bang and put in an envelope for you, and now when you need another coin flip, another random choice, you just take another ticket out of your pocket. You win some, you lose some. Moving the indeterministic choosing of the lottery tickets up to the present moment doesn't change a thing. Well, you might say, well, wait a minute. If my lottery tickets are all, in effect, chosen back at the moment of the Big Bang, then it's already determined that I'm going to win some things and lose others, some coin tosses, some rolls of the dice and lose others. That's true. But it's also true if indeterminism is true. If indeterminism is true, it is still determined you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. It's just not determined which ones you're going to win and which ones you're going to lose. The idea that determinism is your enemy and indeterminism is your friend in the free will department is, I think, a colossal mistake. It has several millennia of tradition behind it, but it's never been properly defended, and I think it's just plain false. But it takes more than a couple of intuition pumps to secure that result. A philosopher named David Wiggins once wrote very movingly about what he called the cosmic unfairness of determinism. Well, why didn't he also write about the cosmic unfairness of indeterminism? You're in the same predicament either way. Either determinism is true or indeterminism is true. You don't need one of them to be true in order to have free will. Well, now that's just a couple of intuition pumps about free will. Does it settle anything? No. Philosophers seldom really settle anything. What they do in that chaotic, informal arena of working on the questions is they offer candidates for fixed points. They try to sort of put a pin on the wall and say, that's a fixed point. Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. And this is a fixed point and this is a fixed point. Now, what happens when we try to keep these fixed points and make a theory come out? When it works, philosophy makes progress, a new science is born. When it doesn't, we have to move the fixed points around. They weren't really fixed after all. We have to reconsider other options. But if what your task is trying to anchor a few fixed points on a very difficult issue, I highly recommend that you use intuition pumps. But you have to look at them with the eye of an engineer. As Doug Hofstadter said when I coined the term, he said, right, These arguments are often intuition pumps. And what we want to do is turn all the knobs to see what makes them work. So you want to reverse engineer the intuition pump, do subtle variations in the conditions and see, is this a robust explainer, persuader that works even under variation, or does it depend critically on a very tiny detail which innocently passes into the thought experiment without due consideration? So my book has no less than 77 chapters, each one a thinking tool or intuition pump. I encourage you to try them out, take them apart, see what makes them tick, and by doing that, you will become a less gullible and more creative thinker. Thank you very much.
Before we go to questions, I'll remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and we're honored tonight to have Dr. Daniel Dennett speaking to us about his new book titled Intuition Pumps and Other Tools for Thinking. We'll now go to our audience questions, and I'm going to do my best here to try to consolidate questions so that we don't get too redundant, and there are several that I think are a good place to start off, at least in the ones I've looked at so far, and that is, why did you choose the term intuition pump to describe your process?
Well, there's already the term thought experiment. And they're thought experiments. But some thought experiments are really formal arguments, very clearly can be couched in formal logical terms. The last line is really a conclusion, and they're just as good as a mathematical proof. But a lot of them aren't. A lot of them are more informal, and they depend on an element of dramatization to get you to the conclusion. So it's not quod erat demonstrandum, it's, oh, yeah, man, that's got to be right. And you sort of pound your fist on the table and say, got it. That's an intuition. You're not quite sure why you have that hunch, but it's been pumped by this thing that has just been presented to you. And after I coined the term, and Doug Hostadter, this was in the mind's eye, came up, he picked up right on, he liked the term right away, and he said, that's it, and we want to use that and talk about turning the knobs on the intuition pump to see what's really doing the work. And what we find, and I exhibit this in the book, is that many intuition pumps that are very familiar and very persuasive are actually defective. And you can show where this intuition pump blows smoke instead of sheds light, and where it pulls the wool over your eyes. And I use the term because I wanted to encourage this sort of engineering attitude towards these things. Wait a minute, this is an interesting gadget. How does it work? Take it apart, understand how it works, and you'll understand something about thinking at the same time. Hmm.
Consolidating two questions here. Involved in a lot of thinking and analysis are assumptions that we don't know we're making. Do you have any tool that helps us uncover those hidden assumptions?
Yeah, actually I talk about this in several places in the book. It's particularly hard because when something goes without saying, it's invisible. You don't see it on the page, you don't hear it. And in fact, one of the defective tools that I discuss is something that the biologist Sidney Brenner has dubbed Occam's broom. Not Occam's razor, but Occam's broom, which is a tool for sweeping inconvenient facts out of sight. And his point is that it is used even by honest, hardworking scientists, it's very, very tempting to ignore certain studies that, oh, I don't want to have to show what's wrong with them. So Occam's broom is often wielded. It's particularly used, though, by propagandists, by polemicists. And what you need to know, as the intended audience of polemics, for instance, conspiracy theories, they always look wonderfully persuasive because Occam's broom has been used very well to sweep all the inconvenient facts off the scene. And if you're not an expert on the topic, you won't know that because you can't see what isn't there. Another thing that I say in the book about unexamined assumptions is whenever there seems to be an argument between two sides that are just unresolvable, it's just they're at loggerheads and there's no motion, it's just been bang, bang, bang for a long time, what you want to do is hunt around for a shared assumption that isn't true, that both of them make. But the very fact that they can't seem to do that means it's hard to find these. But at least you know that's what you should look for, so that if you happen to find one, you'll recognize it as gold when you get it. So notice I'm not saying, here's some good advice. Wherever there's a controversy, try to think of an assumption that both sides are making that isn't true. Well, both sides are making tacitly 20 trillion assumptions. Most of them are true. and most of them that aren't are irrelevant. So it's not a very good way to proceed, but it just means remember that that's a common foible to look for. You can't hunt for it, but if you see it, you'll recognize it.
Well, in the words of our famous defense department philosopher, the danger is in what we don't know that we don't know.
Oh, yes. No, I think that's the only thing that man ever said that I applaud.
You mentioned, this is a question for me, actually, because you mentioned Occam's razor, and I think it would be interesting to explain how that's a tool as well.
Yeah, it's one of the, at the beginning of the book, I list about a dozen very simple sort of hand tools, and Occam's razor is one of them. It's not a principle, it's just a rule of thumb. And it goes back to William of Ockham, a scholastic logician, philosopher, and it's often put this way, do not multiply entities beyond necessity. What that mouthful means is don't have a complicated theory with many ingredients when a simple theory will explain just as well. It's the recommendation that you go for a simple account first and squeeze out as much of the gratuitous curlicues as possible.
What scientists like to call elegant.
Elegance, yes.
Yes.
And it's quite wonderful how often elegance mm-hmm. proves to be truth. But it's very important not to assume that just because you've got an elegant theory, you've got a true one. John Brockman's edge.org asked last year what's your favorite sort of false, what assumption do you wish were true it wasn't? And mine was one that I just love, and it's probably not true. There are sea turtles that mate on one side of the Atlantic and go all the way across to the other side of the Atlantic, to lay their eggs. Mm-hmm. And you think, what a daft energy-using thing to do. And the theory said, well, they started doing it when Africa and South America were together, and they were just going from one side of the bay to the other.
Yeah.
And over the eons, It just got to be a longer journey, and they had no way of keeping time. That was an elegant idea. And it very nicely draws attention to the fact that continental drift has taken place during the time when animals have been around. It wasn't, didn't all happen before there were land animals. And so something like that could actually be true. Yeah. I think, in fact, it's unlikely to be true in the case of these sea turtles. But it's a beautiful idea which may not have any real world applications.
But at least it's simple.
Yeah, it's simple.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. How do your tools work, and do they work differently or do they work the same for group thinking? In other words, when it's not an individual but a group constructing a shared meaning.
Well, one of the simple tools that I discussed at the beginning, one of my favorites, I'm really glad you asked me about this because I like to spread the word about this, is a method that I've now used several times to great effect, which is using lay audiences as decoys. Here's what happens. When experts talk to experts, the worst sin is to overexplain, because that's insulting. Especially if in an interdisciplinary area where there's a disagreement, if you overexplain your view to another expert, you risk insulting that person. So everybody automatically, unconsciously, they underexplain. They err on the side of underexplaining. And then people talk past each other. No use urging them at the beginning of the workshop, please, 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 don't talk past each other. Explain, go into the details. People just can't do that. Here is a really good cure for that. You bring along three or four bright undergraduates. And they're in the room, and everybody knows they're in the room, and everybody knows what their purpose is. You're supposed to explain everything to them.
Yeah.
This immediately gets you out of worrying about insulting the expert who's over on the side listening in. You explain it to the undergraduates. Their job is to resist if they don't get it. That's why you can't use graduate students. Because they will fake understanding at all costs.
Yeah.
Only undergraduates will say, I don't understand that.
Yeah.
So you want to use undergraduates if you're at a university or lay people otherwise. And what often happens is that expert A, here are two experts that have been like, you know, Dracula against Wolfman for years. And expert A says, well, here's what the issue is, and spells out her version of what the issue is. Expert B says, oh my gosh, that's what you meant all along. Oh, I didn't realize that. And we can get resolution right there. Or sometimes it takes a little longer. Sometimes it doesn't work. But it works well enough so it's well worth trying. And, may I say, when you do this, the undergraduates get one heck of a good education out of it. They love it. And even though they know they're just there as sort of decoys, it makes for a very good workshop. I highly recommend it.
Well, we'll all volunteer.
Yeah.
At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned that the job of philosophy is to make sure that people are asking the correct questions. How do you know when it is settled that a question is the correct one? In other words, what's your metric for deciding your job is over?
Well, you never do, really. Yeah. I mean, that. And that's okay. For me, working the particular topics that I work on, when I find that some of my ideas are being picked up and utilized by scientists to do experiments or to do experiments, I think, all right, that's good. I've at least got something clear enough so that this points to a program of research that can now be conducted. Now, maybe maybe I hoodwinked them. Maybe I pulled the wool over their eyes. Maybe they shouldn't have gone running off with my suggestion ringing in their ears. But they do. And I very much appreciate it when that happens.
I remind again our radio audience that you're listening to Commonwealth Club of California with Dr. Daniel Dennett. We're discussing his new book on intuition pumps and other tools for thinking. You talked about people setting up what seemed like falsely confident positions by using the term surely and so forth. And one person comments on how Stephen Gould seemed to be so successful at using words like surely or rather, I believe, is another one. And could you comment on that?
Yeah. Steve Gould was a friend of mine, and I sat in his seminar, and he actually came to my seminar for a while. Then we sort of had a falling out because I thought he was misrepresenting evolutionary theory to America and tried to show him that. And then when I wrote my book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, I included a chapter specifically devoted to what I thought were the misrepresentations of evolution coming out of Steve's work, which led to some very thorny and difficult repercussions afterwards. But I think I did the right thing. I'm glad I did it. And one of the things I learned along the way is that Steve is an absolute master at rhetorical tricks, and his work is full of them. And although I have been criticized in some quarters for sort of settling scores, I thought I would draw attention to three of his best known, his best tricks, show their dirty tricks, and get people to look for them. And they are rathering, piling on, and the Gould two-step. These are all species of the genus Goulding. So what's rathering? Rathering is when you say, it's not that blah, 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 it's rather that ta-da-da-da. Notice what happens here. The word rather tells you you can't have them both. Either it's this or it's that. And no attempt is made to show that you can't have them both. Now, the technical term for what is often introduced by rather is a false dichotomy. You've heard that term. But who knows how to look for a false dichotomy? Well, rather is a very, it's like surely. It's a word which very often marks a false dichotomy and should really be looked at. Now, for philosophers, this is really serious. Gould wasn't a philosopher, but it's serious for everybody. But philosophers like to have formal arguments, and many formal arguments absolutely depend on dichotomies. And they like to argue, look, it's either P or not P, namely Q. Now, if P is true, then ta-dum. If Q is true, ta-dum, you get the same result. So you see, no matter which side of the dichotomy you start with, you end up at the conclusion. That's a lovely form of argument. There's some brilliant formal examples where that works in mathematics, for instance. But in many areas, it doesn't work because the dichotomies are not really dichotomies. And you can either have both things together or you have these intermediate cases. And for instance, raise your hand if you think that every mammal has a mammal for a mother. Raise your hand if you think there have only been a finite number of mammals. Now you've just contradicted yourself. Something has to give. I call this beware of the prime mammal. Philosophers, when they think about what has to give, they tend to like the idea that okay, that means there's got to be one mammal, the prime mammal, which was the first mammal that didn't, and the only mammal that didn't have a mammal for a mother. Now, which one do you suppose that was? Well, it would have to be the one that had the essence of mammalhood. Well, but there isn't any such thing as the essence of mammalhood. If we went back in history, if we went back in our time machine, we would see there were reptiles, and then there were therapsids, weird reptilian things, and then there were mammals, and there would be a period of actually millions of years when was anybody's guess which of these should be called mammals and which should be called therapsids. No one of them deserves the crown of being the prime mammal. And notice, we don't need it any more than we need to have a magic moment when day turns to night. If we need to set an arbitrary limit, we can do that, but it's arbitrary. And so these dichotomous kinds, which are required for some philosophical arguments, are, and philosophers will bang their fists and insist on them. And I say, no, nothing that's as complicated enough to be interesting has an essence. So you just have to get rid of that idea that there are these sharp lines in nature. Biology doesn't need them, so we don't need them in general. I won't go over the other Gouldings. You can read the book.
The Gould two-step, I think.
Oh, the Gould two-step. That is one. I didn't name it. I did describe it in some detail in commenting on a rather nasty review he wrote of a book by Helena Cronin, The Ant and the Peacock, a wonderful book about evolution. He really dumped hard on that book, and he performed the Gould two-step. Here's what you do in the Gould two-step. First, you caricature your opponent's position. Refutation by caricature. You straw man, straw person. You straw person your opponent's position. Then, everybody knows that trick. But here's the genius. Then you go and look at the person's work and you find the passages that belie your caricature, that show that the person doesn't hold that view anyway. But instead of saying, oh, sorry, I caricatured you, you interpret them as concessions on the part of your opponent who has seen the light thanks to your criticism. That's the Gould two-step. And it is simply intellectually dishonest, and he used it a lot.
Question on language. To what degree are the tools you suggest vary as a function of the language that an individual is speaking and thinking in?
First of all, I don't think you can do any of this thinking without language. Language is just the enabler of all of these thinking tools. And that's really what sets us apart from all the other animals. That's what explains the incredible explosion of competence in our species. That's why it's so interesting to ask, when did language evolve? Mm-hmm. And was there a period of proto-language? These are hard questions. There's a lot of interesting speculation and some good theoretical work trying to get at how language could have evolved in the first place and under what conditions. And that's something that I'm now working on as much as I can. It's one of my favorite topics. But I don't have enough that's clear yet to say on that score. But I did say that Every word is a tool. Tools can be misused. You can get a sort of word fetish and have to interpret things in terms of a limited vocabulary, which then blinds you to alternative ways of looking. I think if we become self-conscious, a bit more self-conscious about the language tools that we use to articulate our theories, we'll do better, we'll think better. Now, everybody knows that already, I realize. Even the most austere and rigorous scientist will spend a few hours trying to think of a really vivid mnemonic name for the pet theory, for the idea. They're advertising, and that's okay. You want to have an unforgettable name for your particular contribution to the conversation. So it's worth paying attention to the words in the same way that advertisers and propagandists pay attention to words. They're potent, and they get you in trouble, and they can get you out of trouble. And they are an ineliminable part of good thinking.
How do we come up with a tool that helps us recognize that maybe there is no one answer for a problem we're trying to think through? We have to recognize the possibility of ambiguity or indefiniteness.
Oh, yeah, I think that happens a lot. I have one tool in the book which is designed to alert people to that as a possibility in a case which is very influential right now. The philosopher David Chalmers, who is one of my loyal opposition on matters of consciousness and the mind, and Chalmers made a very successful coinage in talking about what he called the hard problem of consciousness, capital H, capital P, the hard problem. Some of you may have heard of it. He said there's the easy problems of consciousness. Those, of course, were the problems that I and people in cognitive neuroscience were making real progress on. But we weren't even touching the hard problem, which was about subjective properties in a certain way. And he said, this is a very, very, very hard problem. And he got people excited about the hard problem. And you can go and find people like Francis Crick and Christoph Koch and other worthy researchers say, I'm not trying to solve the hard problem. I'm just working on the easy problems. So this mythology grew up about the hard problem. Well, I've never believed there was a hard problem. I thought it was an artifact of his imagination. How to prove this? Can't prove it. However, I can at least give you a reason for thinking it might be true. And this is the tuned deck. It's a bit of card magic. Ralph Hull, famous card magician of the 20th century, had a trick called the tuned deck with which he fooled all of his fellow magicians. This was a trick for magicians. Here's how it went. Boys, I've got a new trick. It's called the tuned deck. I have this deck of cards. It is tuned. The vibrations permit me to locate cards. Buzz, 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 buzz. He'd hold it up to his ears and riffle the cards. This deck is tuned, and I will now show you how it goes. Here, pick a card, any card. The card would be picked from the deck. It would get put back in the deck. He'd do some more buzz, 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 and then the card would be produced. Aside from the buzz, buzz, which was clearly baloney, what was this? What was the trick? How was he doing it? He said, I defy you to explain how I do the trick. So his fellow magicians would huddle and they'd talk about it and they'd say, well, you know, it looks like a type A trick. I'm not going to give away too much here. I'm going to give away this trick, but not all the details of sleight of hand. Well, they can prevent him from doing a type A trick, so they can test this hypothesis. They say, do it again. Hull violated a prime rule of stage magic by repeating a trick. You're never supposed to do this. But on these occasions, he would do it for his fellow magicians. So he'd say, I got a new trick. It's the tuned deck and buzz, buzz. And they would prevent him from doing a type A trick, and he'd still do the trick. And they'd scratch their heads and say, well, I wonder, maybe it's a type C trick? Well, if it were, then we could make it hard for him this way. So they test the hypothesis, it's a type C trick. He still does the trick. They try something else, he still does the trick. So they're baffled. They want to buy the trick from him, he won't sell it. They'll do it 20 times in a row for them. They're completely stumped. Finally, Later in his life, he wrote it up and gave it to his friend Hilliard, who published it in his book on Greater Card Magic, and explained what the trick was. And he said, bless him, he said, the boys were all looking for something too hard. Now, oftentimes in stage magic, you may know this, the trick is over before you think it's even begun. And I'm going to tell you right now, the trick was in its entirety in the name of the trick, the tuned deck. And in fact, it was in one word of that name. Which word?
The.
The. Here's what he was doing. Remember how the trick goes? I've got a new trick. It's called the tuned deck. The trick's over. He then proceeded to do a type A trick, just as they thought. But then they would prevent him from doing that. So he'd do a type B trick. And then he'd do a type C trick. And when they refuted the hypothesis that it was A, B, or C, he could go back and do a type A trick. And he just stayed one step ahead of them, doing whatever trick they let him do, and not realizing that he was actually doing all the tricks they already knew. And they didn't tumble to it because of the word the. Now, that doesn't prove that David Chalmers is playing the Ralph Hull tuned deck trick on you. It doesn't prove it at all. But at least it opens up that as a possibility. I want you just to go away from here thinking, maybe it's just an illusion that there's a hard problem. Maybe if you put all the easy problems together, there's no residue, which is what I hold.
Well, somebody clearly had looked at your book because we have just a few minutes left, so I'm going to ask you about what are the easy problems, because I found them pretty hard. How does the first easy problem, how does consciousness enable us to talk about what we see, the sounds we hear, the aromas we smell, and so on? What would be the easiness about that?
Well, it's not easy at all. Yeah. In fact, as the philosopher David Rosenthal once said, I was talking with David Chalmers and Rosenthal at a conference. Rosenthal said, David, I like your easy, hard problem distinction. It's just that you got the terms reversed. The hard problems are the ones that we're working on in cognitive science. And the answers are voluminous. We've got a lot of good work on vision and on audition and on memory and on how you can adjust the phenomena in various ways. It would take me an hour to give you a good sketch of the sort of work that's being done.
Right. I was bringing it up more as a tease to the audience, because if they go to chapter 56 in the book, when you go out, you'll see a description of this. It's really quite a fascinating thing. Dr. Dennett, I want to thank you on behalf of our audience for giving us this wonderful set of downloaded apps for us to think about thinking, which is really what we're talking about here.
Well, thank you very much.
So
I've enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. The Commonwealth Club is now adjourned. Thank you.